Yeah.
Get water over here.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And before I forget, I want to thank John and Kathy and all the committee for asking Linda and me to come and share here this weekend. It really is a privilege to come and share anywhere, but this, what a setting this is. You know, it's a terrific place. And I used to drink. I better throw that in right now. You might think I'm some kind of an imposter or something. I actually drank quite a bit. And what I did, I went into a bar when I was 18 years old. You're supposed to be 21. And went into a bar in Los Angeles, and I ordered a drink. I got all dressed up in a suit of clothes and a tie and everything, and going to make my adult statement, you know. And I walked in that bar, and I ordered a highball. I don't know what it was, but probably bourbon and Coke or something, you know? And the guy served me. And he didn't ask me how old I was. And immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink in a bar, over the bar, without being asked. And I've arrived, you know. And I felt comfortable in that place. Sometimes, you know, you hear people say they came to AA and their very first meeting, they walked in and they just felt like they came home. Not me, but I sure felt at home in that bar, I'll tell you that. I knew I belonged there. You know, I just liked everything about it, and I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I could sit at the bar and look myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I just went back every opportunity I had. From then on, I drank. On a regular basis. And I drank for 30 years. Linda stole my line, but I'll say it again anyhow. You know, I was under the influence of alcohol for 30 years. I wasn't drunk all the time, but I was thinking about it and recovering from it and all that, you know. And I didn't go anywhere that they didn't have alcohol. Alcohol was the focal point of my life. And so I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? And we got married and moved out in a little tract house out in West Covina, California. It's a little bit east of Los Angeles. And we bought this place nothing down, of course. Yeah. And the payments were $56 a month, and that included interest, taxes, everything, you know. And I had trouble making those payments. You know, the payments had come due, and I just had trouble making them, that's all. And I used my money to drink with. And so I'd say, well, I'll just skip it this month, and I'll make double payment next month. Next month would come along, and I have to make two payments plus the late charge. You know, we almost lost that place several times. And we finally sold it and moved out of there and moved in with my father for free. And that's the way it was. Get on our feet a little bit financially and leave my dad's place. But she didn't drink. You know, I'm always suspicious of her because she didn't drink. And she'd take one drink and get sick. And I used to say, come on, have a drink, you know, loosen up. And we'd go to a party or something, she'd just sit there. Our marriage was really a turbulent marriage, to put it mildly. You know. We fought a lot, and we separated a lot. She'd come home from work, and I'd be there already to took a little time off from the job, and I'd be home already and have four or five drinks in me and all that. And she'd come home, and for some reason, it just, she'd just to get angry just because I had a couple of drinks, you know. And so she'd kick me out of the house. And, you know, when I look back, it always slays me. You know, I was the one that was working. I was the one that was making payments. How could she kick me out of my own house? You know, but I had no self-worth back in those days. So I just left. And I didn't move very far from home. I just down the street. And then I'd work my way back in. And we're in and out, back and forth, and she divorced me 3 times. And the last time she divorced me, I says, you know, this game we're playing here, you know, you want a divorce, you've got it. You can have the house, you can have the furniture, you can have everything. All I want is my old stack of records, my old 78s. And so she was glad to get rid of me and those records. And so I moved to a little shack in Hermosa Beach, California. Actually, what it was is a garage that they had made living quarters in. And the landlady said, we're just a half a block from the ocean. I said, really? No kidding. And I thought, man, that's going to be great. I'm going to get up every morning at 6 o'clock, and I'm going to run 5 miles along the ocean edge, and then I'll plunge into the water, and I'll ride some waves in, you know, body surf some waves in, and man, I'll feel good, and then I'll go to work. And you know, as far as I know, the ocean was down there. I never really got around to checking it out for sure. I was going to. You know, I was going to, and I only lived there 4 years. You know, I was getting ready to go check, but a typical day back then was that I'd wake up at 9 o'clock, and it already 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work, and man, I'd get in my car and weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there. You know, I knew by the time I got there I'd be fired, because you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I left all these papers all over my desk and in my desk drawers, and I had papers in the desk drawers. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. You know, if I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. If I didn't turn them in, I'd be fired. And today was the day, and that was it. And I got to get to the office and check everything out. Everything appeared to be the same. And go get a cup of coffee, come back to my desk, try to look interested, make excuses to my customers. They want to know where their stuff was. It was in my desk drawer where it was, you know. And I'd make excuses. And, you haven't got that yet? I'll just do some research on that. And, you know, I'm one of the originators of the computer excuse. You know, we've all heard that excuse. The computer's been down for the last 4 days, and as soon as it gets working again, I'll get a printout of your policy, and I'll check it out and call you. And I used that excuse before we even had a computer in our office. At a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. They sold martinis over there. And I liked martinis. They sold double martinis for $1. The regular ones were 75 cents. This was a long time ago. I went into a nice restaurant recently, and a single martini, not a double, a single, was $3.75. My God, I couldn't afford to drink now if I had to, you know. But anyway, a double during the lunch hour was $1. And I figured, you know, you're going to have two anyhow. So you better order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you'll need the money, you know. And so I'd order the dollar one. And I'd get to checking my drink against the guy sitting next to me at the bar, and he'd have a 75-center, and I'd say to myself, where are they getting this stuff from? This is not a double. It's a little bit larger than a 75-center, that's all. You know, who do they think they're kidding, anyhow? So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon, take messages, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach, stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, and get home about 2 or 2:30, and I'd sit on the edge of the bed after changing into my pajamas, and sit there on the edge of the bed, and I'd say to myself, well, you know, you've done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. Then I'd put one of these old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd go into my fantasy. You know, about, why don't you just get a second job? You know, and you use that money to pay off the bills. You know, hell, I wasn't working the first one. You know, then I'd say to myself, well, wait a minute, you don't need a second job. You're in sales. You can make any amount of money you want to make, within reason, of course. By God, that's right. And, you know, I come up with these ideas. Sometimes I wonder where they come from. Man, that's the solution, you know. To work every waking moment that I'm starting tomorrow, every waking moment I'm going to be doing business. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. I can do that. People take jobs in Saudi Arabia and they work for 2 years, hardly ever get a day off, you know. And I don't have to leave town, I can do it right here. God, what an idea. That's it, you know. By now I'm playing some upbeat music because I've got the solution. You know, I'd sit there and I'd fantasize what I was going to do with the money. You know, by the end of 365 days, I'll have paid off all my bills, buy a new car, pay for it in cash. I'll even buy her a car, and I'll buy her a white Lincoln Continental. And I'll drive it up to that house where she still lives. And I'll stop and get a call at the Hallmark card shop, and I'll buy one of these real sentimental cards. And you know, those sticky poetry, that really sentimental stuff. And I'll write on it, you know, on the left-hand side, thanks for all the good years. And then I'll put a gold-plated key in the envelope with the card. I'll drive that Lincoln Continental up to the house at midnight. I'll hang a U-turn in the cul-de-sac, and I'll coast up in front of the house. And park right directly in front of the house. And I'll tiptoe up to the steps, and I'll put that card down the mail chute, and then I'll split. The next morning she'll get up and she'll go through her routine, you know, and she'll check her mail, and there'll be an envelope with no stamp on it, and she'll open that one first, and the key will fall out. She'll wonder what the key's for, and she'll read that poetry, you know, that sentimental, sticky poetry. And tears will just roll down her cheeks. It'll just be excruciatingly painful for her to read that. And then she'll get to looking at the key and wonder what the key's for. And somehow she'll look out in front of the house, and there'll be that white Lincoln Continental out there. And she'll realize that that's her automobile. Then she'll be sorry, by God. I don't know about you, but I get a big, big charge out of buying those expensive gifts. And I'd look up at the clock, and it'd be 10:45. And it can't be 10:45. I just sat down there on the edge of this bed. Can't be that late. It's impossible. I'd call the operator and check the time. 10:45. Gee, where is this day gone? I can't believe it. And then I'd realize that the liquor store closed at 11. And so I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and run 2 blocks to the liquor store and get, that's when I first started jogging about that time. Because I had to get there before they closed. And I'd get there just as they were closing up. And a bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood. Then I could stroll back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd go back and start rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give, because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year, and somewhere in there I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning and it'd be 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. Oh man, I'd throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out, get to the office. I knew by the time I got there I'd be fired. And that's the only thing I had left. That's the last bit of respectability I had left, was my job. And I worked for a big company, and I had a business card with my name on it, you know. And that's who I was. And if they fired me and took my card away from me, then I'd just be a big zero. And so I didn't want to lose that job. And the funny thing about this thing is, you know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. And yet, I was able to be one of the top producers in the company. I got a plaque for outstanding salesmanship, and every year, you know, they give me a big plaque with my name on it for outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and all that stuff, you know. I really did used to work around the clock towards the end of the month, you know. And so I got a call from my ex-wife, and my son had he used to come down and visit me sometimes on weekends, and I never knew what to say to him. And if I wasn't drinking, which was rare, but I used to try not to drink when he came down. And I didn't know what to say to him. What do you say to a 16-year-old kid? I couldn't think of anything. And we'd just sit there and stare at each other and look at the TV a little bit. And then I'd have a few drinks and loosen up. And then I'd slobber all over him and tell him how much I loved him. That you're a love child. You're not an accident. You were planned. And he would just look at me, you know. And I'd try to hug him and give him a kiss and everything. And he'd just look at me. I still can't forget that look he used to give me. You know? And the next morning, I'd wake up and I would take him home, drop him off, and not say a word to him. I'm just ashamed of myself. Not that I had been drunk the night before, ashamed that I told my son I loved him. And I just get to the house and open the door, and out he'd go, and I'd go my way. But I got a call from my wife, and she said, "Come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are." And it seemed that he had went to a Christmas party and got drunk, and they took him home, and my wife grabbed him and threw him in the house here, and threw his wingtips in after him, and she called me, "Come and get him," you know. And what I should have said is, "Wait a minute, you know, you won him in the divorce settlement, you know. Now he's getting in a little trouble, now you want me to take him?" That's what I should have said. But what I said is, "Okay." And I went and got him and brought him back to this little place I lived in. And you know, that was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've still got going to this day. I got on him, you know, and we did homework and all kinds of stuff, and his grades started getting a little better, and he was feeling pretty good about himself. And his mother came down to visit one day on a Sunday, and she saw we were doing good. And so we got to talking. And one thing led to another. It was, "Why don't we sell that house up there and pay off all our bills? You can move in here, and we'll start a family again, you know." And she said, "I won't even fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't. And little did I know that during that 3-year period we were separated, divorced, she had started drinking, and she became an alcoholic immediately. You know, and she was a bad alcoholic. You know, she was a badly behaved alcoholic. You know, some people just shouldn't drink. And she was one of those, you know. And we moved in, and geez, you know, things were bad before. My God, when she started drinking, it was just pure hell, you know. And she did stuff like, you know, I like to play these old records, and I'd play a record, and man, that record would be like 30 years old or something, you know, and man, it's a good song. And I'd play it again. And I'd play it one more time, and then again. And it used to drive her crazy. And she'd walk over to the phonograph and take the record off the turntable, and, "Don't break that record," I'd tell her. You know, "That's a collector's item, and can't replace him." "Good. I'll never want to hear that song again." You know? And that's the way it was. And in fact, one time, you know, I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I get hung up on a trumpet toot on a record. And I'd lay that needle in, you know, and toot, oh man, you know. And then I'd get the needle and put it back in the slot and toot, yeah, yeah. And I'd do that 4 or 5 times, and she went over the phonograph one night and just took the arm of the phonograph and just bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you. And that's the way we lived, you know. She threw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. Because I looked at her funny, yeah. And I had a little Sony TV, you know, just a little tiny one. Yeah. I think she had bought for a present for me. And she took it out in the kitchen one night and took her hammer and just killed it, you know, just. And that's the kind of stuff that was going on, only worse, really. And so we went back to therapy again, you know. We'd been going to therapy off and on for about 15 years, and we went back, and she used to tell all those people there, it must have been 6 people, you know, in therapy, and tell them how much I drank and everything. And I said, "Well, you drink too. Why don't you tell them how much you drink, and what you do when you drink?" And we'd come out of those sessions, at least me, I'd come out of the session, and I'd just, my gut was on fire, and I couldn't hardly wait to get a drink, put out the fire. And this therapist says, "You really drink as much as she says?" And I says, "Yeah, sure I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't, you know?" And I said, "Well, have you ever thought of going to AA? And have you ever thought of quitting?" And I says, "Well, as a matter of fact, I have thought about it, and starting tomorrow, I am going to quit." And he says, "Well, AA, you know." And I says, "I don't want to go to AA." I said, "I've already been to AA." And I had been to a meeting about 2 years prior to that. It was one of these meetings where in California, that meeting, they give chips, only they give them at the beginning of the meeting. And they ask, "Is there anyone here that just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip and tell us how you did it." And so here comes this guy up and gets his chip. "My name's Joe Blow. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody, you know." And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. And I just can't begin to tell you how wonderful it is. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. You know, anyone else just finished their first 30 days? And here comes this little lady running up all excited. You know, she gets her chip. "My name's Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. It's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody, you know. In fact, I love everybody in the whole world, not just alcoholics, everybody I love, you know." And it just made such a dramatic change in my life. I just can't begin to tell you all. My children used to look my way. They had a look of fear in their eyes. Now when our eyes meet, there's a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life. And my kids were failing in school, and now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. And when I wake up in the morning, I reach over and grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. I thought, my God, I don't know, I just can't stand this, you know, and what have I got myself into here, you know. And I wasn't able to attend the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. And I went and got one or 20, I don't know, you know. And so I told his therapist, you know, that I been AA, and just some kind of a religious cult of some kind, and it's okay by me if they want to go to it. There's nothing I'd be interested in. And so he put me in touch with a doctor. I was going to get antabuse. And, you know, if you drink on top of antabuse, you get sick and all that. And so I called the doctor's office, and he told me, "Don't drink." The receptionist told me, "Don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming to the appointment." And I didn't. Strange as it may seem. And I got to my appointment, and the doctor said, "Is it true you haven't had a drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming here?" And I said, "That's right." He says, "You don't need antabuse." He says, "You're over the hump. If you can go 2 full days without a drink, you need never take another drink as long as you live." And that's right. Scared the hell out of me, you know. I planned on quitting, but wasn't quite prepared to quit that long. And he went on and on and on about the disease of alcoholism. You know, people that have the disease of alcoholism have character defects. You know, instead of dealing with their character defects and taking care of their business, you know, they drink tonight instead. And they wake up the next morning, they still got all their problems, only now they've got a hangover on top of it. And he just went on and on and on about this. And I finally told him, well, doctor, if you're not going to give me antabuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see, I'm not making much of an impression on you. And he said, I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell my patients, but due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you something. He said, my wife is an alcoholic. We've tried everything known to medical science to help her. She's been in the hospital. She stays in the hospital for 30 days and comes out, and within a week she's drinking again. All this stuff works, you know, it works temporarily. It's up to us to do something, take some action about it. And so she's never been able to stay sober until now. She is sober. 7 months, she goes to AA, and that's what I recommend that you do. And he says, on your way home, stop by the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and get a meeting schedule and start going to meetings. And he says, there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. And I did buy the book, and I got the meeting directory, and I threw it up on the dresser, and had another drink. And crazy doctor, what kind of people I'm running into lately, you know? My wife and I had a big fight. Worse than usual, and I went to my brother's house, and our son went somewhere, I don't know where he was, and while I was gone, in a blackout, she decided to commit suicide, and she pulled the drapes down from the windows, and broke all the records, and threw them all out in the backyard, she just tore that place apart and went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, just ripped everything to pieces, cut the pant legs off my pants, and you know, just even stabbed my damn shoes, you know. And it just was a terrible thing. And then she turned on the oven in the kitchen oven, the gas on the kitchen oven, and went to bed. The next morning she woke up. And that old place we lived in, just a half a block from the water, and the wind used to whistle through those boards, and hell, you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it in that bed. So she survived. And she had been with me when I was at that doctor's, and she went back to him, because she did this in a blackout. And she went back to him and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know, but my wife will be happy to take you to meetings if you want to go. And that's what happened. And that's the reason I'm standing up here tonight, is that my wife went to AA with the doctor's wife. And every once in a while, be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting with her. And I went to meetings off and on with her for almost a year. And they would ask me, are you Lou's husband? And I'd say, yeah, I'm Lou's husband. Well, are you an alcoholic too? And I'd, no, I'm not an alcoholic too. And she's one. Work on her. And I just, you know, I'm a visitor. And I decided to quit drinking. I did actually quit. and a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I went clear through Christmas without drinking. Through the drinking is part of the year, and I didn't drink. And so I was sitting there thinking about the situation, and I don't know, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic after all. If you can go 40 days without a drink, you probably, you know, probably not an alcoholic. And I went to the liquor store and I bought a half a pint of vodka, and I drank it straight down. What did I buy a half pint for? And I went and got a fifth, and I drank that, and I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday, and I woke up Sunday morning, and it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm already an hour late to work, and it's the day after the holiday, you know, and you have to go in the day after the holiday. You know, if you don't go in to work the Monday after a holiday, you're an alcoholic. I learned that right here in AA. And so I went in, but I was sick, really sick. And I poured all that alcohol into my system all at once, and I had a bad reaction to it. And so I went over to the bar a little earlier that day, and I had a Bloody Mary, because that's what you have when you're sick. It's not really a social drink of any kind. It's medicine. And I had a glass of medicine, and I drank it straight down, you know. And it, man, that was really fun. And I said, you know, make me another one. And I looked down. I had spilled half of it all over my tie. And I went to the men's room and tried to clean the tomato juice off my tie. And when I came back to the bar, he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. And I went over to the coffee shop section of this bar and had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. And you know, it's really funny how people quit. My sponsor was kicked out of the Midnight Mission in Los Angeles, and he went to try to sell his blood, and it was too soon. His blood, just, you know, they wouldn't take it. And so he walked like 50 blocks or something to the clubhouse. And he got to the AA clubhouse, and they said, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm really sick. And he said, I'll go in the stock room and lie down and sleep it off. And he hadn't had a drink since. And that was 42 years ago. You know, and how, you know, we quit at the least opportune time. And when you plan on quitting, you don't seem to quit. You know, it just, and anyway, I haven't had a drink since December the 29th, 1969. Just a little over 30 years now. And I'm very grateful for the time that I've had, because I've had a great adventure. But I've had some tragedy in my life too. And I was able to deal with it without drinking. My wife came to my office and told me she just came back from the doctor, and the doctor said, I got cancer, lung cancer, and I got 30 days to live. And man, you know, by then we had two houses. We had a house in San Fernando Valley and a house out in the desert. We were living out in the desert at the time. And so, you know, I said to myself, you know, what's the use of planning? You know, nothing's going to work out. It's just, you know. And I took that news really bad. And it was going to inconvenience me for her to be sick, I'm ashamed to say. But I went to my meeting that night, because I've been trained. If it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. And no matter what. And there's a guy that lives in Moorhead, Minnesota, Don, and he says, if you don't go to your home, you always go to your home group no matter what. The only time you don't go is if there's a death in the family, yours. That's the only time you miss your home group. And so, I went to my meeting. And it was just an ordinary, average, okay meeting. But at the end of the meeting, like they do in a lot of meetings in Los Angeles, and we do in our group in Charlotte, we read on page 164 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it states that ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. Now, obviously, you can't transmit something, have got, and on and on. That's it. Our house is in order. You know? I had long since paid off all those bills, and things were good. And my wife and I were current in all our affairs. Everything that needed to be said had long been said between her and me. And so I was able to, I knew when I drove home that night that I was going to be some help to her, and I was. And she lasted 5 years, not 30 days. And she died on her, a few days after her 16th AA birthday. And it was a damn shame she had to die. And, you know, she was too young to die. If anything, I should have been the one that got cancer. I smoked a lot longer than she did, and all that, you know. And I had those feelings, but I didn't have any guilty feelings, because, you know, you hear people, they lose one of their loved ones, and then they wish, I wish I would have said this. If only I would have done that. You know, could have. Yeah, and. See, I had done everything, and I don't have to say that, because I was there for her. And so I was able to make the transition there. And my friends flocked around me, and renewed effort in AA, and went to a lot more meetings than I'd been going to. And after a respectable time went by, I started thinking of the ladies, and I'd get home, you know, and I'd think, why didn't you ask that gal that you met that gave you the phone number, why didn't you ask her for a date, you know? And then I'd say to myself, well, she wouldn't go out with you. What makes you think she'd go out with you, you know? Well, why wouldn't she go out with you? And I'd have this argument with myself, you know, why don't you call her? You've got the phone number. You know, well, she's not going to say yes. You know, well, call her. You know. So I call her. You know. You want to go out Saturday night? Sure. Geez, what the hell am I going to do now? You know, I don't know anything about relationships. You know, I've been married all my life. And some lady friends, and things were going okay, and I really was doing well, and then I went to Charlotte to speak at a little convention there, and I met Linda, and I had met Linda, shook her hand anyhow, when I spoke up in Madison, Wisconsin, one time, and she belonged to a group up there, a guy that got sober same time as me in Los Angeles. He went back home to Waukesha, Wisconsin, and started a group there. And Linda ended up in that group. And so we knew a lot of people in common. You know, a lot of people from the Pacific group in Los Angeles used to drop by there. And so we hit it off, and I told her, I says, you know, if I'm ever back anywhere near here, I'll call you, and maybe we can have dinner together. And she said, that'll be fine. And so I was pretty close one time, about 1,200 miles. So I gave her a ring, and we went out to dinner. And one thing led to another, and we bought a house and got married, and we've been married for over 6 years now. But you know, the thing that I wanted to say is that she wasn't looking for anyone to marry. She wasn't looking for anyone to fix her. She was already fixed. You know, she didn't need somebody to to make her whole. And neither did I. You know, AA had fixed both of us. And we weren't so hungry for the opposite sex that we absolutely had to have someone in our life. And so, as a result, we've got a pretty good relationship. And we've got to do a lot of stuff together. And we've been to Paris, and we've been to London, and we've been all over, you know. And it's been a great adventure. And my son used to look at me real funny back in those days. And when he was about 16, part of the reason he was looking at me so funny is that he was stoned out of his gourd. It turned out that he was an alcoholic too. He was drinking and using drugs. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself in to AA when he was 21 years old. And if he makes it, he'll be sober 27 years on May the 27th, just a week or two from now. And he's a businessman, and he makes a lot of money, and he's got a beautiful home and a wife and kids, and he's really doing well. And I have a daughter that moved to Boulder City with her husband in Nevada, and they're doing well. And so, you know, our family has matured in spite of ourselves, you know, and because we've all been in program. My daughter was in Al-Anon for a long time. I don't know if she still goes or not. I don't really think she does. But anyway, she got the benefit of Al-Anon for quite a while. My son is sober, like I say, going to be sober 27 years. I'm sober 30 years. And I have a grandson, my daughter's son. And he's sober, I think, 14 years. And we're an AA family. And we weren't any kind of a family 30 years ago. You know, if we were in the same house, we were all in different rooms. You know, we weren't, things were not going very well for us. And now it's been a miraculous change. And why? It's steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor, a tough sponsor. I guess they call him tough, I don't know. He's always been kind to me, really, but he doesn't stand for any nonsense. And he insisted that I work the steps. By the way, I mentioned working the steps one time from the podium here, and the next speaker was a book Nazi. You know, one of those guys that... And he said to me, he looked down from the podium and he says, "You know, Hank, we don't work the steps." He says, "These are the steps we took." That's what it says in the book. So I just couldn't resist. I just hollered back up at him. It seemed like work to me at the time. So I'm very grateful to be here tonight, and John and his wife Kathy have been taking real good care of us, and he's going to drive us back to Orlando tomorrow, and I'm not going to be able to hear Joe, and I'd really love to hear him, but they're going to send me a tape, and so I'll look forward to getting that in the mail. And about all I can say about AA, really, is it turns out that this is a spiritual program. And I know I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.